Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the 2021 Utah legislative session kicks off under unusual circumstances. We'll delve into police reform measures on the Hill and the effort to put pressure on schools to resume in-person classes. Plus, a new president means a significant change in public lands policy and a likely reversal of strategy on two Utah national monuments. And Camp Last Hope, a new kind of homeless encampment, takes shape in Salt Lake City. On the phone for this discussion, we have Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Taylor Stevens. Good morning, Taylor. Welcome.
Good morning.
We've also got reporter Courtney Tanner with us. Hi, Courtney. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Hey there, Roger.
And also Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Good morning, Robert, and thanks for being here to you.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Roger.
And a little bit later on the show, we will also hear from Tribune Public Lands reporter Brian Maffley. Listeners, a reminder that you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to our handle at KCPW. We have got a lot of news to get through today, a few legislative items to get to. But Taylor Stevens, I mentioned that it's an unusual unusual legislative session. For the moment, there's no in-person participation on the part of the public at the Capitol. Lawmakers are there, though, so I thought that we might talk about that. But also, given the fact that people can't attend committees to testify in person, can you give us the sort of primer on how residents of the state of Utah can get their voices heard this session?
Yeah, like you mentioned, it has been a really unusual start to the session for a number of reasons. Number one, because of COVID-19, everyone's required to wear masks, social distancing. Committee hearings are being held in big rooms where everyone is very spaced out. Usually the Capitol is kind of buzzing with activity at this time of year. But also because of the protests that we've seen, and especially the Capitol riot in Washington, D.C., there was a heavy presence of the National Guard up here this week. A few protesters on Inauguration Day, but nothing major. As far as how people can participate, the legislature is very much encouraging public participation. But as for the moment, it does have to be all virtual. Eventually, the Capitol will open up and there will be more of a blended session where people will be able to come in person with the, you know, caveats that they must wear a mask, they must social distance. But if you want to participate now, there are several ways to provide public comment on a bill, and we've got a primer that explains, kind of walks you through each step of how to provide public comment. But you are able to attend the meeting virtually and raise your hand spontaneously during public comment to be called on and provide your comment, sort of as if you were in the meeting.
Right.
You know,
and is
physically.
Is it, Taylor, a just, you know, Zoom sort of video link, or when you're providing that comment, are you doing it via, you know, just text? Are you speaking to lawmakers using your own voice?
Yes, you do have the option to attend virtually through Zoom. You do need to provide some information, your first and last name, your email address to gain access. However, if you are someone who doesn't have access to a internet connection or maybe just don't want to provide comment in that way, you can always provide comment through email, through phone. All lawmakers' contact information is available on the website le.utah.gov. So there are multiple options for ways to provide public comment, depending on what suits you best.
Okay, again, you can find that primer of how to join at sltrib.com. And Taylor, lawmakers are, you know, keeping distant from each other. They are there in person, but you've got plexiglass dividers in one of the chambers. I read that at some point they sort of expect the pandemic, they expect COVID to enter the Capitol. Is that correct?
Yeah, my colleague Bethany Rogers reported on this week. They do anticipate, you know, it's difficult with the transmission rates that we have in Utah right now and the number of people in the legislature, that there won't be some type of COVID case eventually. So, you know, they are kind of anticipating the only thing that they're constitutionally required to do in a session is pass the budget. So that is a big focus and emphasis this session. And if they absolutely had to, they could end the legislative session early. However, they do anticipate with the precautions that they're taking, and those include, you know, biweekly or twice a week COVID tests, rapid COVID tests, they anticipate being able to stay in for the full 45-day session. But they have some contingency plans in place just in case, which you kind of need to do in these times.
Right. Well, you mentioned the budget. Let's turn to some of the other business underway at the legislature. And I want to begin actually with a legislative story on the intersection of the pandemic and education. And for that, let's bring in Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, lawmakers are advancing a measure that exerts some kind of pressure on schools to hold in-person classes. What kind of pressure are we talking about, Courtney?
Yeah, and it really is pointed at one specific school district. But
right.
Yeah, the point of the bill is that any school district that doesn't reopen in person by next month, or at least offer some in-person option by next month, could lose funding, essentially.
And how does that loss of funding happen? I mean, does it just get cut from the budget, or I guess explain that part of this?
Yeah, it's a little bit of like a three-step dance. So essentially, schools get money per student that they have enrolled. And it kind of varies per student if a student has like special needs or something like that. But it's called the weighted pupil unit, and it's about $4,000 per student. Under this bill, if a student left a district that wasn't offering an in-person option, then their allocated pupil spending would go to the district that they transfer to, or even a private school, which has caused some concern because public funding usually doesn't go to private schools.
And as you said, this is pointed at one specific district, the Salt Lake City Schools District, who have not had in-person classes. I guess a decision they made at the school board level because of transmission rates and because of the pandemic. They are set to kind of begin again in-person learning, correct?
Right, and that's kind of the interesting part about this bill is that the Salt Lake City School District, which is the only school district that has remained online so far this school year, had voted the day before this bill was heard in committee to actually reopen. So they kind of were already set on having that happen, right? So they voted to have their secondary schools, their junior high and high school students, return on February 8th. And they had already previously voted to have their elementary students start returning on Monday, actually. So some people feel that this bill is a little vindictive. And the sponsor, Todd Weiler, has said that he doesn't want it to be punitive, but he's going to hold it on the reading calendar until he sees that Salt Lake City School District actually follows through and does reopen next month.
Does it matter, you know, the percentage of time that the reopening happens according to Weiler's bill? Meaning, I know that I guess the question that I have is, will the plan that Salt Lake City Schools has in place, if they do follow it, prevent this measure from having the intended impact, assuming that it does pass, come back off of the being on hold, I guess?
Right, yeah. If Salt Lake City School District reopens, Senator Weiler has essentially said, you know, nothing's going to happen, right? It's fine, it'll move forward, it won't lose funding. But if for some reason they postpone or they don't reopen, then he'll take it off of hold, essentially, and try to get this bill passed so that they would lose the funding.
And educators are supposed to be up shortly to begin getting vaccinated against the coronavirus, aren't they? They've been bumped up in line?
Yeah, some have actually already been vaccinated. So it started last week, and in Salt Lake City School District, for instance, 1,100 have already been vaccinated, which is about a third of the staff that they have there.
Meaning they've probably gotten their roles. Oh, sorry. Yeah, go ahead, Courtney.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah, the rollout kind of, there were a lot of doses last week, but it'll be slower in the following week. So it won't be done for a couple weeks, essentially.
Right. And you need the two doses to become vaccinated and wait a little bit. I'm going to quickly remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to @KCPW. I want to bring in news columnist Robert Gierke. And Robert, I feel like this is a conversation that we've been having for a while. Everyone says that remote learning is not, you know, the ideal situation, but it seems like nothing is ideal right now and when we're in a raging pandemic. And so I guess, yeah, what's your take here, Gierke? What do you think about Wyler's bill? And also, you know, it's hard to make a decision on in-person learning.
Yeah. Andy Larson's already obviously written a couple explainers about what we know about the impacts of opening schools. But ultimately, this has typically been a local control decision where the locally elected school board gets to make the decisions. And in this instance, the legislature is acting like the statewide school board and kind of stepping on their authority. It's, you know, their prerogative, I guess. They allocate the money, but there is a philosophical element to this, especially as Courtney mentioned, since the bill may just end up being that sort of hammer to get the Salt Lake City School District, you know, back to work or back to in-person learning. These are hard decisions to make, and usually we've just trusted the local leaders to make them, but in this instance, the legislature, you know, it's not good enough for them. I think we'd like to see students back in school, but you have to be smart and careful about how you do that.
You mentioned Andy Larson. He has a great explainer on the data of schools and the pandemic today in the Tribune. And the data doesn't say, you know, do this or do that, but Andy brings up the various things that we should be considering, the long-term health of kids who get COVID-19, and he points out that there may be long-term consequences for those who don't show symptoms. We also have to consider the short and long-term health of kids who don't go to school, and then obviously the lives of teachers and staff at schools. Robert, from your, you know, news columnist perspective, is the decision that the school board made in Salt Lake City, was that basically the result of the pressure exerted by state lawmakers?
I mean, I think pretty clearly it was, and you know, there are teachers and their parents who are upset about it. There are teachers and parents who probably wanted to get back in the classroom. Senator Wyler said that he was sponsoring this bill, you know, on behalf of teachers who were trying to get the Salt Lake City School District to go back to in person. So, I mean, but I think they buckled to the pressure. Sure, I mean, the dates are not coincidental. I don't think that for resuming classes. You know, again, it's the legislature using its big hammer to, you know, exert its will on local authorities.
Hey, Courtney Tanner, another question. We've got to head to a break soon here, but are lawmakers talking about teacher safety in the meantime, meaning while we wait for vaccinations to happen of those teachers or to be completed? Is that part of the discussion underway at the Hill?
You know, I'd say that they mentioned that. Like President Adams has obviously said that teacher safety is a priority, and, you know, his daughter is a third grade teacher, and, you know, he's brought that up. But they've mostly said, you know, the vaccines are underway. That is teacher safety. We've already prioritized that. That's how we're covering that base, essentially.
And then, Courtney, I'm worried we've missed a big part of this story, which is the obviously the impact on students is significant, and you've reported on this before, but yeah, I guess more generally, did we miss something substantial from this story before we head to a break?
I think that maybe one of the big things is that, you know, there was a lawsuit at the same time with the legislative pressure. So, you know, the Salt Lake City School District was really, you know, there was a lot of heat on the district to do something. So this lawsuit was filed by 8 sets of parents who essentially wanted the option for their kids to return in person. You know, they cited an increase in failing grades, which the Tribune has reported on, has happened obviously in elementary, junior high, and high school. So essentially there was just like a lot of pressure on the Salt Lake City School District between this lawsuit and legislative leaders.
All right, that is Courtney Tanner, an education reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, and we're going to head to our first break in the show. Thank you for your coverage of this, Courtney, by the way. When we come back, the police reform proposals up for consideration at the legislature and Camp Last Hope, a different kind of homeless encampment in Salt Lake City. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Courtney Tanner and news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can call us to join the conversation. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW. We left off talking about the legislative session, and we will stay there for a bit longer. Taylor Stevens, the actions of police officers were the focus of 2020's summer of protests. The viral video of the death of George Floyd at the hands of police in Minneapolis, that was the sort of straw, you know, the final straw that broke the camel's back. And so huge protests nationwide, a call for change. And some things have already been accomplished in terms of policy changes. But now a few Utah lawmakers are trying to do more. This is a very broad question, but Taylor, I'm wondering if you can give us the lay of the land when it comes to police reform legislation at this year's meeting of lawmakers. Not an easy task, but what do we mean when we say police reform? And we can start talking about what's up for consideration.
Sure thing. And these proposals are, you know, vast. Some of them have to do with creating more consistency among law enforcement agencies when it comes to internal affairs investigations or the data that they produce and share with the public. Some of the other bills that they'll be expected to debate are whether police should be required to de-escalate a situation, whether an officer has a duty to intervene if another officer is using excessive force, if police should be required to give a warning before they use deadly force. And we also saw the Senate earlier this week sort of take its first step to pass a police reform bill. They voted unanimously in favor of creating new training requirements for police dogs after there were some issues uncovered in Salt Lake City's police department with the use of those canine officers. So this is really going to be a session where we expect police bills to be a big part of the conversation. And there are dozens of bills that have been filed, both from Republicans and from Democrats.
Are activists and organizations, you know, who were on the front lines of promoting police reform or changes to police, in fact, are they involved in this process right now, in the lawmaking process? Are they exerting pressure on lawmakers?
They've definitely been lobbying for change, and I think that will be that's what remains to be seen. You know, as you mentioned, there was a lot of pressure, a lot of momentum for police reform after the summer. We saw the legislature approve very quickly in a special session a bill to ban neon neck chokeholds similar to the one used in the George Floyd case. And, you know, what remains to be seen is whether that momentum is still there. I spoke with Senator Todd Weiler, who chairs the Senate Judiciary, Law Enforcement, and Criminal Justice Committee, which a lot of these bills will come through. And he said that he thinks the momentum has dissipated a bit, and that he expects, you know, in a session that will be dominated by addressing the coronavirus and figuring out the budget, that this might not be as much of a priority as it would have been had the session happened in August or September.
You know, you mentioned a few measures that of the dozens of bills that are up for consideration. I'm wondering, Taylor, this is a kind of an odd question, but if someone listening wanted to follow just one or two police reform bills to keep tabs on, what would you recommend they follow? Or you know, is that sort of a fraught question? Yeah, I'll let you answer.
I think it's hard to say because, you know, some of the bills that would have the biggest impact or be the most consequential maybe aren't the bills that are going to pass. And so it kind of depends on your values and what you think is most important as far as what you want to be keeping an eye on. I will say that this is a priority for us covering these bills, and so you can always check out sltrib.com, and we'll be keeping an eye on those as well.
Great.
Throughout the session.
I'm going to bring in Robert Gerke, who is a news columnist and who also, I know, wrote about this topic. And Robert, you have a list of reforms that you say, now is the time for them to happen. Everything from banning no-knock warrants to changing the legal standard under which an officer might be prosecuted, basically not giving them the blanket immunity they generally have now. And I guess, you know, Taylor mentioned the fact that some of those that would have the most impact are the least likely to pass. Do you see it the same way? I mean, is that the, like, for example, changing the legal standard for prosecution seems like a harder thing to do?
I think that one probably is a little bit harder. But, I guess I'm hopeful that they will get something passed, get some significant reforms passed, because, you know, there's been so many parties working for so long over these last several months to try to get to a place where there can be some agreement on some of these bills. And so, you know, things like the transparency that it would provide, there are bills to provide more transparency so officers can't go from, you know, one department to the other if they have problems. So, you know, it feels like that could make a big difference. And I guess, Taylor kind of mentioned, you know, if this session had happened earlier, there might have been more momentum for them, but then it wouldn't have been worked on. So hopefully they can continue this. And I say in my column, it's important that they, you know, maintain this momentum and get some real reform passed this session.
One of the things that you mentioned in your column, Robert, is the idea of having citizen review boards that could be a part of every city or every area where there is a police force. Why is that important? Why is having a civilian review board important?
Well, I mean, if proponents of civilian review boards, and I guess I would argue as well that they provide some citizen accountability by the police department. They have to answer to the people they patrol, and not just the chief and arguably the mayor. So, you know, so I think it's important that there just be that additional layer of oversight. The problem is cities have kind of balked it a little bit at being forced to have one. So there's some discussion about, you know, multi-jurisdictional review boards and some incentives from the state to try to get them on board with that rather than just telling them they have to do it.
All right. Hey, Taylor Stevens, I'm wondering, you know, there's just a variety of bills we could go through, but I think I'm going to we'll move on here in a minute. I know that there's one, I think, Robert, you wrote about this too, but to gather more data on police shootings that I guess isn't being gathered the way that, the proponents of this bill, namely Representative Angela Romero, want to see. And this is to be able to track police use of force incidents. Can you describe that at all, Taylor?
Yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head, and I think that, you know, she and others see this bill as important because there really is no public entity that is tracking these police encounters. The Salt Lake Tribune has a database, and we found that 2020 was a record-tying year for police shootings. My colleagues Jessica Miller and Peyton Harkins have been on that. But yeah, basically, you know, just making it mandatory for police departments to collect this use of force data and then to send that to state and federal agencies so that Utahns have more information when police use force, including those instances of deadly force.
And then one more on that front. Speaking of use of force, there's a couple of measures, I think, to have fellow officers intervene when they see, another officer or a superior or anyone using excessive force and telling them to, you know, step in and do something. Is that are those considerations? Is that something that's being considered at the legislature?
Yeah, and there's a few bills that are looking at use of force, but I think the one you're speaking about is from Representative Kira Berkland, and her bill would codify a requirement that if an officer sees another officer using excessive force, that they report that incident. And she thinks that would help ensure that, you know, officers don't feel that if they report, there's nothing to protect them if they report against a higher-ranking officer, for example. So, yeah, just a lot of reform being considered, and it will be interesting to see what, at the end of these 45 days, has actually changed.
All right. Something to pay attention to, along with so much else at the legislature to pay attention to. And again, you can find coverage at sltrib.com. I'm going to remind listeners to join this conversation, 801-355-TALK, or tweet to at KCPW. And we are going to turn, we're going to change topics pretty drastically here and turn, Taylor Stevens, to another story that you covered this past week. And it has to do with a new kind of homeless encampment that has sprung up beneath an underpass on Salt Lake City's west side. It has been dubbed Camp Last Hope. I said a new kind of, you know, encampment. I guess, why is this different?
Yeah, so, you know, as I've mentioned on the show, I've been covering homelessness for about 3 years, spent quite a bit of time in encampments. And Camp Last Hope really struck me as something very different, something that I hadn't seen before. And speaking to other advocates and others who have been around for much longer than I have, seems that was an accurate assessment. But what makes this camp different is that it's one of the most organized that has been seen in Salt Lake City in recent years. There are volunteers who have been kind of helping organize the camp. They have distribution of donations from one end of the camp to the next. They have food distribution, a locked medicine cabinet. Many of the people who live at the camp have been volunteering to help with various needs of the camp community. And so just very, very much more organized and more community oriented than the average encampment that you see where people have kind of just put up their tents next to each other, but maybe don't have that level of coordination.
There's an organizing force behind this camp, according to a number of the people that you speak to in your article, Ty Bellamy. Who is Ty Bellamy?
Yeah, Ty is a community organizer with the Black Lives for Humanity movement. She helped set up the camp, which went up about December 11th, and she's been sleeping there most nights, and she is really committed to trying to help people get into jobs, get their needs met, and get off the streets is her ultimate goal. She is really pushing for the creation of a tiny home kind of city or area where people could get into tiny homes just to get out of tents, get off the streets. And so she has been kind of, as you said, the organizing and coordinating force behind sort of making this camp move and making it run.
There's some pretty remarkable photos in the coverage of this camp that you can check out by Rick Egan. I want to just other questions that I have include how is the city, how are homeless services providers responding to the idea of an encampment like this? I know that frequently there have been some controversies around cleaning up camps, that is to say, moving people who are experiencing homelessness, who are congregated away from where they are congregated. Can you talk about that, Taylor?
Yeah, and that, you know, is one of the big concerns for Ty and other organizers at this camp. Many of the people experiencing homelessness I spoke to said that they feel much more stable at this camp, which has been up now for over a month. They're often getting pushed from location to location as the health department conducts its cleanups. And so Ty says, you know, these people need to recoup. They need some time and stability. And so she's really pushing for them to stay. This camp is on private property owned in part by Union Pacific. Union Pacific wants the camp gone. They say that there are safety issues associated with this camp, which is located on kind of an abandoned railroad track area. So far, the health department has not cleaned up this camp. They say that, you know, because the organizers are thinking about things like, you know, cleanliness, garbage disposal, needle exchange, that this camp isn't posing the type of health challenges or health concerns that a typical camp might pose, but it does kind of seem from speaking with the health department that it's only a matter of time before they end up cleaning up this camp and kind of pushing the residents to a different location.
Can I ask, is there, you know, I guess a perennial question that we ask frequently when we talk about homelessness on this program is there space available in the resource centers for, you know, people who are at Camp Last Hope? And what do those who are encamped there say about the sort of official, you know, assistance system?
Yeah, there are a variety of resources, and one thing that the that's new in the system this year, there are two overflow shelters, one located in Mill Creek and one in Salt Lake City. Both of those opened recently, so kind of an overflow for people who can't fit within the three main homeless resource centers. But a lot of the people that I spoke with, you know, some of them are afraid of COVID. They don't want to be in a congregate setting right now. They feel safer being in the open air, that they won't get COVID. Others, you know, don't really want to follow the rules within the formal shelter system. And then there were a lot of couples that I spoke with, and they're often separated in the formal homeless resource system. The new Airport Inn Hotel, which is one of the overflow shelters I mentioned, does have space for couples. But that's also something that keeps a lot of people camping because they don't want to be separated from a partner. So, you know, just like the causes for homelessness are complex, the reasons why people choose to stay outside are complex. Some people do want to get into the shelters, but, you know, have struggled for whatever reason. So there's a variety of experiences there. But one of the concerns from some of the providers, others who work in homeless services, they're concerned that, you know, when people help people on the streets and provide, you know, some services outside of the traditional homeless services system, they raise a concern that those people will then choose not to get into the formal homeless services system, which has access to housing vouchers, housing help, you know, dedicated case management. And so that was a concern raised by Salt Lake City Mayor Erin Mendenhall. She said she appreciates the intentions of these community organizers, but thinks that it can create, you know, these types of camp help and community organizing can create barriers to people getting into formal housing services at the resource centers.
Maybe, I see, maybe delaying the more formal assistance and access to perhaps, you know, funding and so on. Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist, we don't have a lot of time on this, but I'm, you know, Taylor's article brings up the sort of complexity of people experiencing homelessness and that there's no, obviously, there's no quick single fix and you can't just hide people. I guess, how do you, again, good intentions, how do you view, how do you view these kinds of encampments?
Well, I mean, ideally, I think we would have, you know, we would have people in a system, like Taylor mentioned, that not only gets them off the streets, but puts them on a path where they could, you know, get these services they need. I mean, that's the optimal place to be, but you can't also, now you can hear my dog barking, sorry, but you can't force people to do something that they, you know, to be in a place where they don't want to be, especially now, you know, with COVID going, it's you know, even more problematic. So you're kind of hit the nail on the head. There's no simple answers for this. It's going to take a lot of attention, hopefully some attention from the legislature this session to address the issue, and some flexibility going forward.
Taylor Stevens, just quickly before I forget, I mean, looking at the photographs, and they are, I really do urge people to go check out the photographs that have been taken by Rick Egan on this article at sltrib.com. But the, you know, they show people on railroad tracks. These are abandoned tracks, right? I mean, this is Union Pacific owned, but it's they're not being utilized by any kind of freight train or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for clarifying that. We need to head to another break in the show. Taylor, thank you so much for covering this. I know that you have more coverage on other encampments around the valley and, of course, a lot of coverage on homelessness that people should check out. Listeners, check that out at sltrib.com. We are going to head to another break, and there's still more to come, including our underplayed stories of the week and a look at the future of national monuments in Utah. That's after the break here on Behind the Headlines. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Stevens, Courtney Tanner, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. To save time for a recorded segment featuring Tribune Public Lands reporter Brian Maffley, we are going to turn already to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And you know what? We haven't heard from Courtney Tanner in a while. Let's bring you back into this conversation, Courtney. What have you got for an underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, I'd like to highlight something from the Tribune's partner, Fox 13. They did a great story on how much it costs to have the extra security at the state capitol. With all the riots and everything. So on Sunday, it cost $227,000 for just a single day of coverage, and 15 protesters showed up.
Wow. And that's such a strange moment because it was hard to predict what was going to happen. Well, there you have it. Check out that coverage, which I think you can see as well at sltrib.com. Thank you for that, Courtney. Taylor Stevens, let's go to you. What's your pick for underplayed story?
Yeah, my pick comes from Bethany Rogers, who has been covering cannabis rollout for the Salt Lake Tribune. She's got a really interesting story about Utah's medical cannabis couriers who are hand-delivering orders to the homes of some patients, which is a development for some people who face really long drives to get to the nearest marijuana pharmacy. So interesting story. You should definitely check it out at sltrib.com.
Thank you, Taylor, for that pick. Robert Gerke, news columnist, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to recommend a story that Eric Peterson, Kathy McKittrick, and the Utah Investigative Journalism Project did, looking at landlords who, in some instances, after an eviction, have come back many months later to try to collect even more money from these people who've been evicted. And, it looks like they might be abusing the system. And Eric and company do a good job of highlighting some of the ethical questions that are involved.
Yeah, part of a series of reporting that they've been doing on landlords and evictions. Thank you, Robert, for that pick. Good pick. Find it at sltrib.com. I'm going to go with the fact that there's a measure by Senator Derek Kitchen that would let consumers buy sealed pre-made cocktails for pickup. And this is under consideration at the legislature. I don't know whether or not it's going to pass, but it's something to check out and keep an eye on at sltrib.com. And you can get the full story there. Courtney Tanner, Taylor Stevens, Robert Gerke, thank you again for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roger.
We will wrap up today with Tribune reporter Brian Maffley and a look at President Joe Biden's plans for two Utah national monuments. Brian Maffley, public lands reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
So we've got a new president, a new interior secretary pending confirmation, vastly different public lands policy objectives with the change in administration, Brian.
Yeah.
And that brings us to two Utah national monuments, the Bear's Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante national monuments that were downsized by the previous president. So, Brian Maffley, what are President Joe Biden's plans for these two Utah monuments?
Yeah, well, we knew that President Biden would take some kind of action to restore those monuments. We just weren't sure until yesterday what he had in mind. So, his first day in office, he signed a sweeping executive order basically setting us the stage for reversing a lot of the environmental and public lands policies that Donald Trump had implemented. And one of the things he singled out was kind of reviewing the reduction of the Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments in Utah. So what we're seeing here, and I don't think there's a lot of surprise, is this is Biden is pursuing a, kind of going 180 degree about face with what we've seen over the last 4 years. So one of the things I thought was interesting was, the Antiquities Act would have allowed him to just restore the two national monuments. They were cut by 2 million acres between the two of them, but he chose not to do that. He chose to set up a process to instructing the Interior Secretary, who's been New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland has been selected for that, but she has yet to be confirmed. Anyway, she'll have a 60-day window to review those monument reductions and come up with some findings and recommendations on what to do next. So,
can I interrupt for a second, Brian, and just going back for quickly in time, that was the downsizing of those two monuments, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, ever really completed in a legal sense? Like, did we ever get a final answer on whether it's legal for a president to downsize monuments to the degree that Trump did?
Yeah, that is a great question. I'm glad we're getting to that. Well, the decision by Trump to downsize those monuments was challenged in federal court. However, a dispositive ruling has yet to be made. And it looks to me like that's a pretty important question that needs to get resolved. Whatever the outcome is with Bears Ears and Grand Staircase, Trump raised the question of whether the Antiquities Act allows presidents to basically undo monuments that a predecessor did. No president had ever done that, although there's plenty of precedent for monument boundaries to be adjusted, but never a just wholesale downsizing. And that would be a nice question to resolve because, you know, let's say there is a Republican administration comes in down the road that will be under pressure to once again reduce the monuments. There'll be, you know, what's to stop that president from putting the monuments, slashing the monuments again? It seems to me that to get some finality here will take a ruling from the courts or some type of act of Congress.
Otherwise, it remains a political and non-permanent answer for, yes. I guess, the open question of conserving lands. Trump had what he called an energy dominance policy on public lands. He was trying to open up a lot of lands to oil and gas leasing. Just to draw a contrast, I want to read from the article that you and your colleagues, Zach Podmore and Taylor Stevens, wrote. You quote Biden's executive order that directs federal agencies to identify and take steps toward reversing any executive actions implemented by Trump that are, quote, harmful to public health, damaging to the environment, unsupported by the best available science, or otherwise not in the national interest. And you write that there are specific instructions to protect our nation's treasures by reviewing the boundaries and conditions of the Utah National Monuments, placing a moratorium on all oil and gas leasing in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, revoking approval for the Keystone XL pipeline, and reestablishing an interagency working group exploring the social cost of greenhouse gas emissions that are contributing to climate change. Brian, just for anybody who thinks that the presidency doesn't matter or that their vote doesn't matter, they can just reread that paragraph. I mean, a 180 and full speed ahead in the opposite direction.
Yeah, there's no question that Biden is going to be taking this country in a much different direction when it comes to energy, public lands administration, environmental protection, and his selection of Deb Haaland is equally important because as a Native American from the same part of the country that the Bears Ears is, suggests to me that she will be very eager to restore that monument, which was established at the request of five fellow Native American tribes in the Four Corners region.
They wanted it to be bigger than it was designated by President Obama when he did it, but they were still pleased with that initial designation. They were, of course, unhappy, those tribes, with the downsizing. How are they responding to Biden's announcement of this review, the five tribes that called for the creation of Bears?
Yeah, well, of course, they're extremely pleased. And they told Zach, the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition told Zach yesterday that they had already established contact with the Trump transition team to discuss
the Biden transition,
you know, a government to government relationship to decide the fate of that monument. That is a huge step right there because that whole intergovernmental relationship had broken down under Trump. The Trump administration didn't extend that courtesy to the tribes. Basically ignored virtually everything they asked for in terms of, obviously the tribes didn't want the monument reduced. They reduced the monument by 1 million acres. The tribes wanted the management of those lands to be very protective. They got virtually nothing that they wanted in the management plan. So yeah, they feel those tribes, it's the Hopi, Navajo, Ute Mountain Ute, and Zuni. They feel kind of disrespected, and they're very hopeful that they'll get the respect that they think is coming to them. So they hope to at least get the monument restored, but they're also going further to ask that the Biden administration set the boundaries to encompass all the lands that they proposed, nearly 2 million acres, which is about 30% larger than what Obama designated.
Meanwhile, Brian, all of Utah's congressional delegation, the heads of the state House and Senate, the governor and the lieutenant governor of the state of Utah, they are all up in arms. They're unhappy about this review. What are they saying?
Well, I was actually a little surprised by their response because they knew this was going to come. And I thought by having a review, isn't Biden now throwing out a concession to the Utah delegation and state leaders that, hey, we're going to review this and that presumably that'll be listening to the, local folks around both monuments and state leaders. The law doesn't require Biden to do that. So they come out with a joint statement last night saying they're opposed to enlarging the monuments, which I guess is fine, except that the monuments are going to be enlarged. It's just a matter of how much. And so they're kind of staking out a hard position that might not be practical.
Maybe a negotiating position, Brian.
Perhaps a negotiating position. But, Spencer Cox, our new governor, also said something interesting in his roadmap that he released. He wants local management for public lands. And, of course, public lands belong to all the people of the United States. But if we're going to talk about local management, all the local governments around Bears Ears have all expressed, gone on record, passed resolutions saying they want the monument restored, with the exception of Monticello and Blanding, the very conservative towns. They don't want to see the monument restored, but Bluff, Moab, Grand County, and San Juan County have all passed resolutions basically demanding that the monument be put back. So if we're going to talk about the interests of local people and local elected leaders, well, I hope that counts for something. Otherwise, they're being a little bit two-faced. We'll listen to local elected leaders only if they agree with what we want, right?
In their statement, they also refer to the review as a review in name only with predetermined results.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting thing. I mean, in some ways, they're probably right about that. You hinted at it, the idea that these monuments will be expanded because that is part of the sort of policy objective of the Biden administration that's coming in.
Yeah, I can understand why they might be upset that there's preordained result. However, let's point out that when Trump assigned Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke to review these Utah monuments, that his ultimate recommendations were preordained too, to drastically shrink them. So, okay, that preordained process was okay, but the preordained process that Biden's doing to enlarge the process is not okay. I'm seeing a little hypocrisy there.
And again, Biden, of course, could, under the Antiquities Act, not consult with anyone whatsoever and just do this. But he's choosing to do a review. Obviously, do we have a time frame yet? 60 days? Is that correct?
60 days, yeah. We'll see. We're going to keep a close eye on it. And we're really interested to see how this plays out, especially with someone like Deb Haaland running it. It'll be a lot different than what Ryan Zinke did. I'll tell you that.
That seems like an understatement. Brian Maffley is public lands reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And thank you, as always, for joining us, Brian.
Hey, see you later.
Again, Brian Maffley covers public lands in Utah. As they did with President Biden's decision on those monuments, every member of Utah's delegation in Washington, as well as Governor Spencer Cox, Attorney General Sean Reyes, the president of the state Senate, the Speaker of the Utah House, yesterday they released a similar statement on the Biden administration's decision to suspend oil and gas leasing on federal public lands for 60 days. The statement called that decision a serious mistake that perpetuates discord between rural and urban Americans. The suspension of oil and gas leasing, the statement says, will harm the same small Utah businesses that are already hurting from the pandemic. That does it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent local public radio resource. Also heard on Utah Public Radio across the state. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or however you get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week.